First is People Against Casper. Are council here on the Casper case?
Yes, sir.
When you're able to move into the council tables, you may do so. We have read the briefs in these cases. We are familiar with the record, so you need not go through a lengthy recitation of facts. Once again, I'll ask, ladies and gentlemen, the courtroom and counsel to turn off pagers and cell phones so we're not interrupted during the argument. You have 15 minutes per side, and the yellow light comes on when there are 5 minutes remaining for rebuttal purposes. Counsel, you may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Mattis, registration number 37869, here on behalf of Mr. Matthew Casper, the defendant appellant in this matter. In this case, this court will be addressing the question of whether Mr. Casper's confession was involuntary. Now, with the limited time we have here today, I want to go straight to the most important two factors in the voluntariness analysis, which are threats and implied promises. I say that they're the most important factors because the law is clear that a defendant's statements cannot be voluntary if they are extracted by any sort of threats or obtained by any direct or implied promises, however slight. Now, first, with regards to the threat, after Mr. Casper had maintained that he was innocent for, you know, approximately 10 times, and in the context of telling Mr. Casper that the district attorney makes all of the decision as to whether to file a case or not. Rorich, Mr. Casper's interrogator, tells Mr. Casper to think about what would happen, and I'm quoting here, when the district attorney's office gets a report sitting on their table and they read that we felt that you were being untruthful with us. I mean, you gotta think how they're gonna feel and where that case is gonna go from there. That's the only strength that I have. Now, Rorich here
what's
is not.
What's the threat there?
Okay.
I mean, the normal cases that involve threats are, and there was one I think the party cited, where the interrogator threatens the defendant, I'm gonna put your, I think it was a stepbrother, a half-brother in jail.
Right.
That seems to be a threat. Here it's, you know, if you don't tell the truth, it's not gonna be good for you.
Well, he's going one step further than saying, if you don't tell the truth, it's not going to be good for you. First of all, Mr. Casper had been saying, I didn't do anything. So he's saying, if you continue to persist in maintaining your innocence, it's not going to be good for you. Then he takes another step and he says that he, the interrogator, is personally going to file a report if he keeps on with his innocence, maintaining his innocence. He will file a report that says that Mr. Casper was untruthful, meaning basically saying, you're saying you didn't do it, I think you're lying, and I'm gonna tell the DA that. And where do you think the case is gonna go from there?
Interpreting, he said, what if the, I mean, and I don't have the quote in front of me, I've got the transcript in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say, I'm gonna go tell him you're lying, didn't, as I think you just said.
Mm-hmm.
The testimony, what he said was, what will happen if the DA decides you lied? I mean, you're kind of interpreting some, and I'm troubled by that.
Okay.
I'll just be very frank with you, Mr. Mattis. I'm concerned there's a lot of interpretation you make in your brief. It seems to me this defendant had a pattern of, I deny it, well then 2 minutes later, and he's just talking. Maybe it happened, I don't really remember, so I guess I'll say it did happen, and then he admits it.
Right.
The defendant did a lot of talking here without a lot of questions. And so I'm troubled by, I don't know that we can interpret things or imply things. And so please respond to that. Convince me why I'm wrong.
Okay.
But I'm concerned.
Well, first of all, the exact quote is, when the district attorney reads that we felt that you were being untruthful with us, we being the interrogator. Now, as far as, you know, this whole interview is Mr. Casper just thinking up things to try and satisfy his interrogator so that he will file a report that could say that Mr. Casper was, for example, truthful, or he will you know, and I was going to get to this in a minute, he will try and prove to everyone that Mr. Casper is not a pedophile. I mean, Mr. Casper goes through the interview and he's thinking up things that could explain why his accuser is making these accusations. But Mr. Rorich makes it clear that that's not what he wants. He wants Mr. Casper to adopt this, I did it for educational purposes, justification there. And that's why Mr. Casper keeps talking, is because if he stops, he knows that the Rorich is going to file this report that says it's untruthful. And also, if he stops, he's going to be labeled a pedophile, and he doesn't want that.
Let me ask you about the educational purposes, because that did come up. From reading the transcript, it seems like your client is the first one to raise that, in the sense that first he says, my stepdaughter never saw me watch any of these adult films, and never saw it. She'd come in, I'd turn it right off. And then I think the educational purposes, it's him then saying, well, one time she did come in and I showed it to her and I said, I don't want you doing that. I want you to stay away and never do that when you grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the first time that anything that, isn't he the first one that raised this kind of educational purposes? I agree then the detective then ran with that, but isn't that the first time that this educational purpose comes up when he's trying to explain that video watching?
Your Honor, I don't remember if it was the, if he was the first one to bring it up. Honestly, he may have said something like, you know, I told her that that's not what you need to do on the tape, and then he left it at that. But I don't think that he said he was the first one to say, you know, I may have done this for educational purposes. The officer had been suggesting that. I believe, and I'm just going from recollection here, I believe that the officer had said, you know, I think you did it for just to school her on it, before Mr. Casper had admitted anything. I mean, up to what I was just talking about a minute ago, up to that point, Mr. Casper had just denied that any kind of contact had occurred whatsoever.
Well, and things were kind of dripping out, wasn't it? I mean, first thing he said, well, I did take a shower with her, and then he, then as I recall, I think he did, first I think he said that she probably saw me watching these educational things. As soon as she'd come in the room, I'd turn them off, once or twice it happened. Then I think he mentioned a shower, and then I thought he said, well, actually, I guess one time I did show her that those pornographic videos and said, I want you to stay away from this.
He may have said that. I don't think he was the first one to bring it up, but I do remember what you're talking about there. Now, and I'll go back to the pedophile thing, which I think is a very coercive thing to say to somebody, because Rorich first established that Mr. Casper, you know, hated pedophiles, basically. And Mr. Casper flat out said, I would kill every pedophile if I could. And he, Rorich takes that, and then he tells him, okay, well, a lot of people right now have put a negative label on you. You know, to use your terms, a pedophile. And then he says, the only way I can go from that label to something else is by you being honest with me on what happened. And then later on he says, I have to overcome this hurdle, Matt, to prove to everybody that you're not a bad person. And in that context, I take bad person as I need to prove to everyone that you're not a pedophile. And if you continue saying you didn't do anything, then I can't make that proof. But if you adopt this justification, that if you admit and some contact occurred and adopt my justification, then I may be able to prove to people that you're not a pedophile, you're not a bad person. And it can be inferred from that statement that the DA, if the DA is convinced that Mr. Casper is not a pedophile, is not a bad person, he's going to believe Mr. Casper and not Mr. Casper's accuser.
And so this is the implied promise that you were alluding to, I take it.
Yes. It's not even implied, it's expressed promise.
Well, what do you make of page 17, line 13, the officer says, quote, now you need to understand that we can't make you any promises. We can't make you any guarantees of what will happen, anything like that.
Right.
I mean, he couldn't say it any more strongly. I cannot make you a promise.
Yeah.
And so you have that, and juxtapose with what you just suggested, which seemed to be several inferences on inferences. there's this kind of statement, then there's maybe if I believe you, I can go to the DA, and maybe if I go to the DA, maybe the DA will believe you, and maybe this and maybe that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I'm, and again, I want you to respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm presenting this to you. Why can't, I have trouble when I've got a direct statement of I can't make you a promise, Matt, versus the argument you've made about implied promises. Doesn't the direct statement of we cannot make you any promise, hear me out, no promises, trump what you're saying?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and because I think the officer was very careful here to make sure that some things were implied promises or they were kind of under the radar type comments, but the things that could be good for him as an interrogator, he was flat out. He said it, I can't make you any promises. But what I would like the court to consider when you're considering these direct statements versus these other implied statements is that, you know, Mr. Casper is facing a situation where Rorich was telling him one thing and then turning around and contradicting himself a minute later, 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later. So Mr. Casper was put in a situation where he didn't know what to believe. And I'll give you an example. Rorich tells him, and this is a direct quote, I don't want you to say something if you don't think it happened. Okay, that's pretty clear. But then, later on, Rorich turns around and he suggests that Mr. Casper admit to something that he knows did not happen, which is sexual contact occurred for educational purposes. So he's saying, I don't want you to admit to something that you don't think happened, but here, admit to this. I know it didn't happen, but just admit to it. Because I don't think anybody believed any of this educational purposes stuff, okay? And again, he says, I'm not trying to duke you into saying something that I want you to say. But then he makes it clear by suggesting approximately 20 times throughout the 2.5-hour interview that he wants Mr. Casper to say that the sexual contact occurred for educational purposes.
Well, is he really, and I understand your point, Mr. Mattis, is he really saying, no, I want you to say that? Or is he kind of, you know, trying to put him at ease that, look, I'm not judging you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can, I think, and disagree, if you disagree,
mm-hmm.
Read that what the officer was doing is just saying, look, I'm not judging you. I want you to tell me the truth. Look, I'll believe you if it's for educational purposes, but we need to know what happened. And he said several times, we have evidence here. You know, I'm not understanding why this happened. We need you to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't that a fair reading of the transcript?
I think it could be a reading of the transcript, sure. But I think under the whole situation here, I think if you look at the totality of this interview, I think the whole tenor of the interview is Rorich trying to get to help Mr. Casper, to help him so that the DA does not file charges against him. I think that's why Mr. Casper is bringing up all these things. That's why he's thinking about, well, maybe she was coerced. Maybe she saw the porn videos. You know, maybe, you know, I forget what other excuses he has. And each time, Roach just says, no, I think it's, you know, educational purposes. So while he didn't say, I want you to provide this confession that says educational purposes, he was basically implying by not accepting any of the other justifications or excuses that this is the way I am going to help you. If you do this, then I can help you.
Mr. Mattis, didn't Mr. Casper go home after this interview?
Yes, he did. After he said exactly what Rorich told him to say, he was allowed to go home. Okay, if there are no more questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
You've got 2 minutes. Mr. Mattis.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Katherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. Your Honors, this is an interview with all of the characteristics of voluntariness. The defendant was free to leave. He came to the station voluntarily. He was told numerous times he was free to leave. I don't think there's any real dispute that he was not in custody at this point. He was, as a precautionary matter, an advisory matter, given his Miranda warnings, it was made very clear he did not have to make statements. It was made very clear he could have counsel with him before he made any statements, and he chose to make statements to the police. There was no physical coercion. I don't think there's any allegations of physical coercion. There were no direct, I don't even believe, implied promises made. In fact, I think the officer, the detective, went to great pains to make it clear to the defendant that he could not make any promises. The reference as to what would happen, the charging decisions or what would happen in this case, the reference made by counsel to the reference to the district attorney and the report, basically this wasn't an indication that he was going to tell the DA specifically whether he was being untruthful or not. He was telling the defendant, the DA is going to get the report of this case. He's going to read about what happened, read about what the victim's saying happened. And then he's going to have in there whether the detectives who did interview the defendant felt he was being truthful or not. And the DA will consider that. No promises were made whatsoever as to how that would impact the DA's decision. And again, the officer went right along to say, basically, no promises are going to be made.
Ms. Hanson, if I may interrupt you, excuse me for interrupting you.
Okay.
I kind of was candid with Mr. Madison, told him what bothered me about his argument. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you directly what bothers me about yours, and I'd like you to address it if you would. I am troubled by several other factors that you look at in terms of voluntariness. You look at things about whether an officer lied, whether an officer minimized the seriousness of the offense, as two, for example. Several times here, it seems to me the officer overstated the evidence. I know you did it, Matt. We have all kinds of evidence you did it. We just need to know why. He minimized the seriousness of this on several occasions. Page 18 of the transcript, he says, this isn't that big a deal. You know, molesting a 7-year-old kid or whatever she was is a big deal. It's not a big deal. And he makes several comments like that. He several times suggested he knew, he said at one point, I don't know anything more than I told you, Matt. And he knew a lot more than he told him. I'll just candidly tell you, it's troubling to me when an officer is lying to somebody they're interrogating. It maybe lies too strong a word. I know the officer was doing his job, you know, and I'll assume full good faith. Those issues bug me. Why do those not, you know, lead to a finding of involuntariness?
Okay, I'll try and take those in order.
And I'll get them back to you if you lose the train.
Okay, thank you.
I know.
Basically, I don't think there's any point in the record. In fact, in the defense opening brief, he does not even make any factual assertions as to what misrepresentations the officers made. He says the officer, he quotes the officer when the officer says, we have strong evidence against you, we have a lot of evidence against you. There is no indication in the record that that is not true. The victim, in fact, at the beginning of the interview, the victim told the Department of Human Services people, I believe it was, and made several statements about the defendant's conduct. The officer told the defendant, you know, the way she says this, the consistency, the detail, that's pretty strong evidence, and actually explain why the evidence was strong. And I think you'll see that at the beginning of the interview. So basically, while they may not have had DNA, he didn't claim to have DNA evidence. He didn't claim to have evidence of penetrating injury. He didn't claim to have that. He said, we have strong evidence. I know you did this, those kind of things. And I don't think that those are false at all. I think we have apparently a very credible victim here, and the officers believe that. So as for let me go to the next one.
Minimizing the seriousness.
Minimizing the seriousness. I think, certainly, I wouldn't disagree with you at all that molesting a 7-year-old child is not a very serious offense. I think if you look at the officer's statements in context, what he was trying to explain is, you know, this is not, you know, if you look at the whole range of sexual assaults, the type of sexual assaults, this is not the most egregious. And I think that we could agree this was not a intercourse situation. This was not a repeat, certainly wasn't apparently use of force. And so I think if you have to look at the officer's statement in context. I don't think for one second he told the defendant this is not a serious crime. I don't think he said this is not a crime. I don't think he said this is what you did is not a big deal. I do believe that the comments he made, And certainly, you know, it's part of the interrogation strategy. Obviously, this was a very effective interrogator. The strategy was to place into context and put the defendant at ease, and I don't think he...
But didn't he say it's in, I think he said it's in the bottom 5% of what I've seen, and this is...
Yes.
This is a, and it's a separate challenge, which I think this court's repeatedly rejected, but it's a, you know, a lifetime sentence, 8 years to life anyway, and this is not, I think the evidence brought out at trial, this is not in the bottom 5%, I hope, of the crimes that this detective has seen. That seems to be a misleading minimization of what he's facing.
I think based on the record we have, we don't know that. I mean, this detective may have dealt with mostly very serious rapes, violent rapes, and again, it's very hard to even respond to that without, and I don't mean to suggest, I have children of my own, to even suggest that this is not a very serious offense. And I would agree, he made some comments that appear to have placed this type of offense in the bottom part of some sort of categorization. But I believe what he was trying to do is include them in the categorization of violent crimes, or, for example, using the defendant's own term, a pedophile, someone who the common person would understand as someone who preys on children, often strangers. I think when he's talking about that, he's trying to tell the defendant, you know, we're not looking at you as a Mr. Cooley from Florida. We know that this is a situation, I think they were trying to suggest, this is a situation that perhaps is isolated between you and the daughter. But they never went so far as to say, and that's not, that's okay, that's not serious. So I think you have to take these comments in context. And in and of itself, I certainly don't think they made these statements overall involuntary. I mean, I know this court has repeatedly indicated that ruses and comments, even lies, are not in and of themselves sufficient to make a statement involuntary.
Ms. Hansen, isn't this one of the reasons that a suspect gets Mirandized? They're told that anything that they say can be used against them, and they're
right.
Given an opportunity to have counsel present if they want.
Mm-hmm.
The police officer isn't there to make full and accurate disclosure to the suspect, is he?
No. That's not, basically the officer's purpose is to find out the truth. I believe any officer would say he wants to find out what happened, wants to find out the truth. And I think the officer in this case repeatedly told the defendant that. I think the question is that whether the officer did anything to make the defendant feel that he had to confess, that he had to tell the officer things that overbore his will, that made him not be able to make a free and rational choice to make statements. And I think almost everything the officer did here could be viewed in that way, could be viewed as trying to make the defendant feel comfortable and make him understand that what is happening, what's being told against him. He didn't get into too many of the details, but he wanted to find out what had happened. And it's not just the acts of what had happened, but why it happened. And that's the purpose of obtaining a statement from a defendant. The fact that the defendant made an unwise choice certainly doesn't bear on the voluntariness of the statement. And I think, you do have Miranda warnings here, which basically, I think in this case, contribute to the voluntariness of the statement. The defendant knew full well that what he said could be used against him. The officer made clear that he couldn't make any promises as to what would happen, and the defendant chose to make a statement anyway. There's one factor, and I would like to go back. Did I answer all your... I know I talked about the misrepresentations. Did I answer all?
You did. Thank you very much, Ms. Hansen.
I'm happy to answer any other questions about this interview, but I would like to point out one thing before I conclude is at the end of the interview, when the defendant, after the defendant had confessed to all the acts and to his purpose for that, basically there was some general talk about other matters. And at the end of the interview, the defendant specifically told the officer as he was leaving to go, which he was able to leave, I just ask that I get informed of what's going on so that I can have a chance to tell my side of the story. And I think that statement is very indicative of the fact that the defendant was there to tell his side of the story. He said it at the beginning, even though he took him a while to admit to certain things and it took him a while to open up as to what his side of the story was, he asked for another opportunity, wants to know if something's going on. I want to tell my side of the story. And I think that at the very end of the interview is very indicative of the fact that this entire interrogation, this entire interview was voluntary.
Ms. Hanson, I just quickly ask you, the defendant in his opening brief talked about this, the three stages of the interrogation. Mm-hmm. They would talk for an hour or so, then they took a break and went outside, and then they came back and got a pretty clean confession. The defendant suggested or said, and I guess testified, that when they went outside, the police, it really more direct evidence of implied promises and the like. And I don't think you directly addressed, you know, the police side of that story. What happened when they went outside?
Well, I believe nothing was argued by the defendant in the opening brief that anything that happened outside, I mean, if you look at the argument sections of his brief, I don't believe that he argued that anything that happened outside caused him to confess.
You know, what he says was, just to, at least I'm looking at notes, not the brief, mm-hmm. but the officer told him the interrogation would not be over until the police got the answer they were looking for. The officer promised to speak to the judge to be sure the defendant received a fair shake at bond. There are a couple of statements like that. I'm curious what the officer testified, if anything, in response to that, those assertions.
Well, I could be wrong, but I believe that those comments were made in the statement of the facts and statement of the case. I don't believe that they relied on his arguments, but I could be wrong. But basically, what the officers did say in reviewing the transcript of the officer's testimony is that they did not make any of these statements. They specifically denied that. They basically said they went on the break, he went out to his truck, they smoked a cigarette. The defendant tried to start talking to them about, you know, asking, you know, can I make some statements? And Officer Detective Rurich, I believe, told him, you know, I don't feel comfortable talking off the record. Let's go back inside. And I believe no actual discussion of the facts were had outside on the break. I think there was a couple incriminating statements made inside right before they turned on the tape. But from the testimony, which was the trial court didn't make specific findings of that, but in its findings and its conclusions, it acknowledged that there was a break and that the detective wanted to come back inside and not talk off the record. So basically, but they flat out rejected the notion that they made any such promises or comments to him.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hanson. Mr. Mattis.
Thank you. As far as the minimization of the seriousness of the crime, there was no talk of why he was minimizing. He didn't mention violence or molesting strangers. He flat out said that it was in the 5% at the lowest end I've had to deal with. To me, this is not a big deal. Okay. Then later on, he says, I don't think it was major, but I think things happened. Things look 10 times worse than I know it really is. I know it's not as bad as they're making it out to sound. So there's no doubt that he's minimizing the seriousness of the crime to try and get Mr. Casper to admit to what he wants Mr. Casper to admit to, and that is the educational purposes.
As a matter of law, how far does that get you? So he minimized it. So
right.
If we say he unduly minimized it, does that get you, doesn't get you very far in the voluntariness?
No, it's just a factor, but I just wanted to point out that it is there. Okay, and the same with the Miranda question that you had, Your Honor. Miranda was implemented to try and protect the defendant against these kind of coercive tactics, but it's one factor among many that needs to be considered. And also, I would say that it cuts both ways, because I think it's common knowledge that people that receive Miranda warnings are in custody. Every time for a layperson on TV, whenever anyone's getting arrested, they're being read their rights. So I think it's not a leap to say that when you're being read your Miranda, you may think that there might be some sort of arrest going on there.
Well, though some state and federal agencies require them as a matter of internal procedure to any interview.
Yeah.
Even in a home.
IRS, yeah, that could be true. I'm saying from a layperson's perspective, you know, it cuts both ways. Let's see. Okay. Well, Your Honor, I would just ask that this court suppress his involuntary confession and order a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mattis. Thank you, Ms. Hanson. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.